This week in Retronauts, be prepared. Hi everyone, welcome to Retronauts. I am Jeremy Parrish, and this week we are kind of live-ish, if we consider this live, at Retro World Expo, and we are going to talk about Hudson, because I have jumped into TurboWorks, TurboGrafx videos with my video project, and I've been immersed in Hudson, and I figured why not turn that into additional content. It's the way that we live in this modern age and era. And in a bizarre coincidence, yesterday we were at the on the show floor, and someone came up and started chatting with me, and out of nowhere said, I go to a lot of events and talk about the history of Hudson. And there's no possible way he could have known that this was the topic of our podcast discussion off-panel, off-site. And I said, well, this was, you know, since this was a divine intervention here, so please join us for our podcast. So, special guest who randomly wandered into the podcast. It's not often I say I've invited a strange man into my hotel room, but it does happen sometimes because, you know, fate just lines up. So please introduce yourself.
Yeah. Hi, guys. I'm Jimmy Cooney. I own a game store in the Washington, D.C. area called Dice City Games. I'm a longtime collector, started with the NES and just was immediately attracted to the beat. I've spoken at MAGFest, Too Many Games, and a couple other events about the history of Hudson Soft. I did a panel called 50 Years of the Bee and the Story of Hudson. And then I did a panel on the caravan shooting and the caravan in general. So the Hudson Caravan was an exciting time to be alive if you were a gamer in Japan. And I actually think the echoes of it we are still feeling today. So I was really excited to run into these guys, and I said, hey, that book looks cool. And he's like, oh, that's my book. And I recognized his voice, the podcast, and really the Famicom Works and other, you know, series I've seen. So really cool, and a little bit of serendipity to join these guys. And I'm excited. I think this is the most underrated developer and publisher of all time.
All right. And speaking of these other guys, who are these other guys?
I'm Kurt Coletta.
I'm John Anderson.
All right. And we are going to talk about Hudson because they're cool and did a lot of stuff. And the more I read about them and dig into the TurboGrafx, the more I'm like, oh, I see how all the pieces of history have started to line up. Because, you know, the thing that I didn't realize until I kind of started on this journey and even was corrected by a random stranger who puts together the Famicom Fama Daily YouTube show and has moved on to PC Engine coverage, that the division of labor on the TurboGrafx was not NEC made the hardware, Hudson made a bunch of the games. It was Hudson came up with a hardware concept, went to NEC, and they you know, produced the system together. So Hudson, you know, everyone thinks of them as a game developer, like the Adventure Island people. And yes, that's correct. They made Bomberman. But they also had a history working in computers, and there was some knowledge of computer hardware there. And so that came into play with the TurboGrafx, the PC Engine. And we're going to talk about that, but first we are going to talk about how they got to that point. So we will begin by digging back into the 1970s. It's been more than 50 years since Hudson Soft was established, although they were not Hudson Soft at the beginning. How familiar are you guys with their like pre-NES stuff, if at all?
I dream of going to CQ Hudson.
So, yeah. Do you want to explain what CQ Hudson is?
Yeah, they had their Radio Shack style. Really, it was a store. It was more than a store because from it they launched their development, as I understand. And They made many, many of these early home computer games. But in a sense, you know, Japan has the culture of these camera stores and these radio stores. And of course, radio was much bigger in 1973 in some ways. So I feel like a big part of what they were doing was they were tinkerers. And I think that's something I'm attracted to, both their love of cars and trains. And then, you know, and I think that's true of many early Japanese developers. You look at Gunpei Yokoi. He made some of the most important video games, but at the end of the day, toys, tinkering, you know, the mechanics of it all was important to him. I think that Hudson was kind of like that in CQ Hudson, their store, where they had computers, they had radio kits, they had repair items, you know, they had electronics, small electronics, I think was a great place to be, you know, the setting, and allowed them to kind of brainchild as a home base, so... But yeah, from what I understand, it was a store and an office where they sold and developed their wares and many other companies. And so they became familiar with Sharp and Nintendo and Toshiba and all these other companies.
Yeah, Sharp was actually the one that introduced Hudson to Nintendo.
Yep.
I know some of the early adventure games, because there were a lot of other companies at the time that were making them. Princess Tomato and the Salad Kingdom, which ended up on the NES later, and two games called Zeniland, which were a lot of text adventure games where to search for treasures in an area. And the first one was based off of like Disney World, more or less. And then the second one goes off the rails with a lot of goofy characters, and lots of parodies. It's a very funny game.
So just to kind of put the timeline in order, 1973, Hudson is established, not a computer company, not a game company. They are, as Jimmy said, just a shop. And we've all been to Japan. We've all been to Akihabara. We've all seen like the little crowded, basically, essentially like long junk stalls crowded into spaces where... You know, things just line the wall. And I have to imagine that's probably kind of the overall vibe there. And, you know, a lot of those seem to be just run by, like, an elderly couple or something. That's just where they hang out all day, every day, selling people, you know, just random stuff that they need. So, you know, it's kind of remarkable that this company... sort of started from those origins and, you know, blossomed into something so big. But like Jimmy said, they were tinkerers, the Kudo brothers, Yuji Kudo and Hiroshi Kudo. And they created this company and, you know, went from selling gadgets and stuff to once personal computers, the very early, I have to assume, personal computers rolled out, you know, the kind of DIY... Apple One, you know, build it yourself out of wood kind of things and beyond. They would have been familiar with those. And I have to assume that they dealt a lot in not just Japanese computers, but also import computers. I know that was kind of a big deal with like Tandy and Apple computers. And that's how HAL Lab kind of came into the Nintendo world, because they dealt with 6502 based systems that were not prevalent in Japan. So they had this expertise in that technology. So I have to imagine that, you know, all of this just kind of formed a foundation for Hudson to blossom into what they became.
And I've heard that they not only were selling personal computers and tinkering with them, as I said, but the market was so high, they couldn't keep enough in stock. So they were often buying secondhand computers and then sort of souping them up. And, you know, they were making modifications and adding things to them, repairing them. And, you know, the lateral thinking of whether technology starts to set in as you're, you know, as you're tinkering with these other computers. And I read that at some point they were the dominant force in Japanese game publishing by 1979. Something like 3/4 of Japanese home computer video games were developed and published by Hudson. And they started this, I believe it was a mail order service or something, but you know, we grew up as guys who might have grown up in the 80s and whatnot, we remember catalogs and how important they were. Even in American gaming culture, getting the Sears catalog was important. But at the time, my understanding is they had a mail order service, and these games were not just selling at CQ Hudson and other stores, other camera stores and Akihabara District type stores, but they were going out direct to customers. And so that opened up a whole gate. And this is a wild west for video games in Japan, so people are finding their own path. What's the distribution model? What's the right price? What's the right quality of game? What's the right volume of game? And we might find that maybe Hudson was rushing things out a bit. I don't know. That's the criticism I've heard. I've played a few of the MSX titles. I think they're really fun. But
you know. Well, I think their MSX stuff came later.
No,
I think, the earlier stuff, from what I understand, was just kind of like... you know, one of the articles I read in preparation for this said that basically, you know, they were selling computers, and as an incentive for people to come buy their computers, they, you know, just went kind of on the side, programmed their own games, and they weren't substantial games, but they would create, you know, these little video games, and those would come with the computer. So they would give people like 5 or 10 games alongside their computer. So in addition to buying a piece of hardware, you were also getting like
a bundle of
a little something extra. You know, you buy a Hudson computer or a computer from Hudson, and you're getting Hudson games with it. But you know, I have to imagine that dealing with those really early computer systems, there wasn't a lot of overhead for like bandwidth and memory for great finesse, so they were probably very functional, but, you know, at best. But that's kind of how video games were at the time. So, you know, can you really judge them too harshly for kind of falling into the standards of the times? I would say no.
CQ Hudson pretty much really became a gathering place for computer
enthusiasts,
you know. And it was just like the equivalent of Satoru Iwata gathering with colleagues at the headquarters of Commodore in Tokyo. So that was like the one place where people would, you know, Commodore enthusiasts would gather. Whereas this little street in Sapporo, Japan, this little store, Hudson CQ, really became a gathering place, and games began to be exchanged. They were, you know, like you said, they were being given away for free. Mm-hmm. With these computers, and word of mouth began to spread about, you know, these games that the small outfit in Sapporo was developing them. And I think, you know, when you're Sapporo, Japan, it's cold. Winters are brutal, can be brutally cold. Summers can be brutally hot. So what else is there to do? And, you know, go inside, you know, work with the computers, play games and stuff like that. So it's really interesting how this company started out by really becoming a headquarters for computers and computer games, and Hudson also began to develop applications for computer companies and other outfits as well. They were really becoming a, you know, a do-all for computer enthusiasts at that time.
There was a computer series called the MZ80 K2. It was a micro computer of sorts, and they, as the fan culture started growing around these computers, Hudson ended up being the first advertiser in a lot of the Japanese newspapers, and that, you know, allowed that reach to grow. So you've got CQ Hudson, and you have this marketing, and I think that's one of the things I've always been drawn to about them, is their marketing. From the animated logo, you know, of the B, you know, to the way they did everything, even in their last years, the way their team would go to CES and E3 and stuff and give out more demo discs and have lanyards and have pins. And I think the most important thing would be the caravan, which maybe I'm not sure we'll touch on in this.
Oh, podcast. We will, okay, for sure. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, they really were marketing geniuses. And having Takashi Meijin, you know, really, I have this theory, let's call it, that he's the first pro gamer. If we go back and look at it, I mean, we're looking at the first guy really getting paid to play video games and represent video games, and not just like, I'm a playtester. I mean, this guy was good, right? You know, 16 shot, you know, earned his name for a reason. You know, this guy was the best at Star Force, and he was the best at, you know, many of their games, you know, and games like Wonder Boy that would end up sort of becoming Hudson Games through Adventure Island. I think that their marketing was always really special. And in a world where you start as a Radio Shack, and by, I don't know what it is, 1987, 1988, you're beating the Famicom in sales in Japan, that doesn't just happen because some tinkerers are good at programming. Mm-hmm. Their marketing, their understanding of how to reach the Japanese customer base, and perhaps eventually the global customer base, I think is really, really special. So, that, again, I'm drawn to it. You know, when I saw that D on a Nintendo game, ever since, I don't know what the first one I played was, to be honest. I'm not sure if it was Mylon Secret Castle or Bomberman or, you know, which one it was. I really am not sure, but I knew that I started just being drawn to it. And I think that that's got to be a somewhat universal experience, at least for kids in Japan, because they were never shy about their logo, you know, and they were never shy about. And before the B was there, and there's the words Hudson, the font they used, you know, you would see it on these Japanese games, which I own some, and, you know, some of them are cassettes, you know, some of them are floppies, some of them look more like the cartridges we'd know later. And, of course, the B card, which had its iterations on both the MSX and the PC Engine and TurboGrafx, you know, the Hue card or the B card. It's just, it's really special. There was something they were carving out that I just think felt different, at least to the other games I've seen and the other companies I've seen at the time. So
yeah, their first outreach internationally was in England, in the UK. They actually, in the early 1980s, it was between 1980 to 1982. They actually did go over to England. They went over to London, and they did set up a table at one of the computer conventions.
That's so cool.
There, and they began bringing their games over to the MSX, and actually,
which is where you get Eric and the Floaters.
Yes.
Yeah, Eric.
Famously,
it sounds like Eric and the Floaters sounds like a bad band name.
Ladies and gentlemen, Eric and the Floaters.
They actually, if you go on Moby Games and go to one of their early MSX games, you will see their name Hudson Soft on the cassette packaging and a London address. They actually at one point had a London outfit, and then a company, which really does not have a lot of background information of, called Kuma Computers, also began publishing stuff for the MSX. And then they set up a deal with Sinclair to distribute their games over there in the early 1980s. I'm going to say, you know, 82, probably 82, 83, you know, according to my notes, they were distributing games on the MSX in the UK as early as 1984, Driller Tanks for the MSX, and then Kuma Computers distributed titles like Eric and the Floaters, and Binary Land. They were
classic.
Kuma Computers was based in a place called Pangbourne, Berkshire, England, and then Sinclair Research would distribute titles like Cannonball for the ZX Spectrum as early as 1984 as well.
And that culture, the English sort of microcomputer culture, it has parallels to Japan that I won't say didn't exist in America, but each culture was different, right? And the fan base in England for these, like the Sinclair, you know, it was wild. I mean, from what I understand, the people I've interacted with, I had a cousin from Ireland who grew up in England, and it was just so different. You know, he was into these home computers and Game Gear. It was like we were, you know, two ships crossing in the night. He'd come over on Christmas and we'd have a Nintendo and a Game Boy, and he'd have a Game Gear and be talking about, you know, his ZX or whatever. It's just like, yeah. And I think that computer enthusiast culture, I can see that taking off. And the MSX, we kind of missed. I mean, I didn't own one until, I don't know, 10 years ago. You know, it wasn't very popular in America.
We are long overdue for a Hudson Soft compilation.
Absolutely.
It would be great to play, for someone to put together an awesome compilation, right. Work with Konami, the current owners of the Hudson Soft IP, and put together a computer game compilation
of those early
games.
There's a submarine game, a zombie game, a firefighter game. I played little bits of them here and there. They're kind of to pick up and play stuff, you know.
Yeah.
Not quite the genius of Donkey Kong and Shigeru Miyamoto, but it's very in that element. If you like those type of games, it's worth picking them up and playing them. You know.
Yeah, it's really hard to find information on their 1970s output. I don't know if that stuff is very well documented in English or in all, you know, at all, because I think it was just so kind of a la carte, you know, catch as catch can, just throwing stuff out there. But, you know, it did start to solidify around the time the MSX launched. And 1983 was a big year for Hudson in general. Not only was that the MSX launch where they started to focus on that hardware, that's the year that they created their first truly lasting original work with Bomberman, which started out as an MSX game. And, like, gameplay-wise, it's very, very similar. Like, it's pretty much fully formed, and you'd recognize it from, you know, the NES version that came along many, many years later. Although Bomberman himself was not fully formed in that version. He's this portly little guy with a bowler hat and suspenders. And I'm disappointed that you could never play that version of Bomberman as a skin in like Bomberman R or something like that. They need to just bring that back. But I think that's a part of their legacy they don't want to touch. But, you know, that did become an established part of kind of the Hudson legacy, and it was successful enough that they immediately created a really misguided, hopeless sequel called 3D Bomberman, which is like a first-person maze game where you are playing Bomberman from a first-person perspective, but it's not fluid. It's not like, it's not even on the level of Faceball. It's, you know, kind of that stop-start per-screen movement with no animation. It's, you know, it's on the freaking MSX. You can't do first person perspective there.
But they're ambitious.
But yeah, they by God, they did it.
I love making apocryphal arguments about Hudson. Like, was that the first survival horror game? You know, Bomberman 3D. You've got this surprise element. You're struggling through this maze. And, you know.
Now, I'm sure the first survival horror game was something that no one's ever heard of on the Plato in the 70s. But 1983 also was. Apparently, when Nintendo and Hudson signed an agreement for Hudson to come on as a publishing partner, which was something like Nintendo must have just been kind of scoping that out. And it was pretty bold of Hudson to jump in at that point, because 1983, the Famicom was not, it was not a sure success. You know, the Sega SG-1000 had a bigger library and was selling just as well as the Famicom for a while. So, you know, it was kind of, they were kind of putting their chips in with, I think, probably the you know, more sophisticated piece of hardware, but there was no guarantee that Nintendo's business model was going to succeed. But that did, you know, kind of give them the sort of leg up over the rest of the entire Japanese games industry. But at the same time, it was kind of limiting because they had a formal agreement with Nintendo, which gave them, you know, allowances, but also restrictions that some of the other partners who came on, I understand, you know, again, Random Stranger passed this along, but my understanding from what they told me is that Hudson could not manufacture their own games. They could publish, self-publish, but not manufacture cartridges. Whereas the other companies that came along, like Namco, Sunsoft, Konami, you know, the companies that are kind of famous for their mapper chips, their memory management chips, they didn't have the formal agreement. They kind of pushed their way onto the system without necessarily smoothing it over with Nintendo to begin with. So they kind of had this greater degree of freedom, and that actually kind of directly leads to the PC Engine and TurboGrafx, because they couldn't, you know, when the technology started to fall behind, the Famicom started to age, other companies were like, let's make our own cool add-on chips with, you know, memory management and subprocessors and all kinds of extra sound enhancements and, you know, additional RAM for new features. And Hudson was limited to the, you know, the MMC-1, MMC-3, MMC-5 that Nintendo officially manufactured. So, you know, that means their games, when they were localized into America, where people could only use the official mapper chips or memory management chips, like, you know, there were no localization problems. They didn't have to cut things back the way Konami did. But at the same time, you know, their baseline of technology was kind of tethered to Famicom plus, you know, that little extra bit, whereas other companies were just like, hey, let's put, you know, an entire supercomputer on here to play Shogi. They just couldn't do that. So it's an interesting, like a blessing and a curse, I guess, having gotten in there with Nintendo as part of the Famicom camp very early.
Right. And usually they're recognized as the first third-party developer on the Famicom for that reason. And they had this trusted role. You know, they basically developed the Family Basic and worked on a lot of both the hardware and software side of things. And if you play those early games, which unfortunately were locked in Japan, like Binary Land, they feel like black box NES titles to me.
Yeah, know? I mean, Nintendo, I mean, Hudson was very much working in the Nintendo, you know, Mapper Zero kind of space right there. If you look at Nuts and Milk, Binary Land, you know, Bomberman, Lode Runner, Challenger, all of them have that very Nintendo style title screen with kind of cartoonish bubbly font for the name. And then it's like A type, B type, you know, very, very much like this is how Nintendo does it. This is how we're doing it. And so, you know, I mean, if you even look at their packaging and the way they numbered, like, the codes, the product codes for their games, all of that feels very much like this is very, very in line with Nintendo. So they were, you know, they even to the back, the way the back of the boxes just have, like, safety or, you know, electronics warnings instead of screenshots and stuff, just like Nintendo with their, you know, their Pulse Line boxes. So, yeah, it feels like they were kind of either deliberately patterning themselves after Nintendo, like this is, you know, just kind of an add-on to what Nintendo is doing, or Nintendo is like, you got to do it this way. But I feel like it was probably the former is my guess.
Yeah. And that might be a guiding star for them all throughout what we're going to see here, because I find that there are times I think Hudson doesn't get enough credit. Even once you start talking to people who know a little bit about it, you know, oh, well, you know, they just ported Star Force. Okay, well, you're porting, you know, to the Famicom, a popular arcade that people are out there spending money on that's, you know, made by another company that is, you know, played competitively, and you're making, really, after Xevious, probably the most important home vertical shooter of the first almost decade of gaming as we know it. I mean, it very important. So yeah, you could say it's just a port, you know, but on the other hand, this is a very important port, and they would do that time and again, you know. Hudson's ported so many games, and Wonder Boy becomes a great example. But
yeah, and it's not like that was the only version of Star Force you could play at home. Tekkon and Sega collaborated and brought it to SG-1000. I can't remember which one shipped first, but thankfully I have a book right here that has this all laid out. But I, you know, they shipped pretty contemporaneously, and there's no comparing the two. I mean, the Famicom had built-in support for per-pixel background scrolling, whereas, you know, the SG-1000 was kind of locked into the same limitations as the MSX hardware, and they did port it to MSX also, but you know, you can't do the smooth per pixel scrolling. It has to be kind of stuttery, like jumping a tile at a time. So, you know, you look at, let's see, Star Force SG-1000, page 205, and Star Force Famicom, page 212. So they came out almost exactly the same time. Yeah, you have like the fast, slick, well animated, very intense Famicom version, and then you have the choppy, kind of not so great SG-1000 version, and you know, I think they did Nintendo favors there for sure. Like, look at what this hardware can do versus, you know, a one-to-one comparison with the competition.
And then, you know, the opposite happens. So, not to jump ahead too far, but when they had the opportunity to bring popular Nintendo franchises to Japanese home computers, famously Super Mario Bros. Special, the opposite happened. People say, it's so bad. It's the worst. I've heard this. It's the worst version of Mario. I'm like, listen, hardware limitations are everything there. It wasn't that Hudson couldn't develop a game that scrolled. It's that it wasn't going to happen on the hardware. So the same thing could be, you know, Tekken and Sega are competent. You know, they could have done a great home console port, but you're working within hardware limitations, and I think it's something they thrived at. As their NES games develop, you go from these very simple games we're talking about now to late NES titles like Bonk that people are just shocked this game could end up on the NES. Big, beautiful sprites, fluid animation, you know, so much emotion in Bonk. But I think that, like I say, imitation is the greatest form of flattery. And, you know, one of the most important things is to learn and absorb, learn from your mentors. And Hudson was, you know, modest enough to constantly do that. You know, I see that just constantly with Nintendo and other, you know, they'll work with a smaller developer like Red, and they'll learn a lot, you know. Exactly, with Westone, yeah. And I don't know, we could get into the great Wonder Boy Adventure Island debate.
Oh, we've done that on Retronauts before. It's exhausting. We don't have time this morning. We have to move on and talk about something that's not that, because that'll be the whole morning right there.
Yeah. But the point is that they were competent in all of these ports and all of these. And something I marvel at is that, I'm not sure of this. This is not a research take. This is just my take as a player, collector, and you know, owner of a video game store and so on. You've got a company that touched more franchises than almost anybody. I mean, there's a Hudson Super Mario Bros. There's a Hudson Tetris. There's a Hudson Street Fighter or Fighting Street. You know, there's a Hudson Wonder Boy and a Hudson Star Wars. There's a Hudson everything, you know. The Hudson Lode Runner, a Hudson Pang, Buster Bros. You know, the amount of franchises they've worked with, developed, published is probably unparalleled, and it's certainly the top 1%. There's just no one that touched that many franchises and really made competent takes, you know, for a long time to say, this is the best R-Type, you know, this is an amazing Ninja Gaiden, you know, anything that whether they were the lead developer or they were publishing it and had some developmental role in it, I think they just did an amazing job with, you know, this, anything they were handed. And I think there's nothing wrong with not just being an innovator, but also being kind of the workhorse of the video game industry. And sometimes that was their role.
Yeah, and I have to give them credit for pushing the boundaries of what people were doing technologically on the Famicom. Like, if you look at some of the ports they made, Radon Bungling Bay is the first game to have all-direction scrolling, as opposed to scrolling in one direction, which is not something the Famicom NES hardware supported at a basic level. So they had to gimmick that. And then they did the same thing with Challenger's top-down stages a few months later, or like a year later. So, you know, they were pushing the boundaries for sure, and like using the hardware in ways that Nintendo wasn't. I think when Radon Bungling Bay came out, there was only maybe one or two Nintendo developed games to even have screen scrolling at all. I think Devil World and Ice Climber might have been it. So, or maybe Excitebike came before it. Yeah. But anyway, there weren't a lot. Like, Nintendo was just beginning to get out of that single screen game design mindset that, you know, you saw in Hudson's early work. But Hudson was like, well, we've been making all these games on computers. Let's start bringing those over, or bring over licensed games from, you know, from America or whatever, and see what we can do on this hardware. And
so in Japan, Radon Bungling Bay and Challenger are before Super Mario Bros.
Yeah.
See,
Challenger's like a week after or something, but it's right around the same time.
But yeah. Certainly not way behind. They're not waiting for cues from Nintendo.
No, for sure.
You know, and I think Will Runner was Dougie Smith, is that right? And was Radon Bungling Bay Will Wright?
Yeah.
So, I mean, every time they worked with these people, whoever it was, Nintendo, we'll get into perhaps later, they, at least in the West, they published the first game from the creator of Pokemon. You know, you get, every time they work with someone, they learn. They came away better. And I think it's just, it's so remarkable, because then the next game in the series would be better. Love Star Force, Star Soldier's better.
Yeah, Momotaro Dentetsu is a great example of that. It's like a board game RPG that came about because the creator was friends with Yuji Horii and said, I'd love to make a game. And Horii was like, you should make a game. You should make an RPG. And he said, oh, that's going to be too difficult. I can't, like, I've seen how harrowing this development process is on your team, and I can't sink my life into something like this. So instead, he made kind of like a, you know, game of life style board game that has RPG elements and, you know, kind of focused on his love of travel and, you know, urban development. Mm-hmm. So it's a weird mix of things, but it created this you know, extremely popular series in Japan that continues to thrive and survive to this day. And it is very much like, oh, you know, the creator of Dragon Quest gave me the nudge to do something, but I can't do what he's doing, so I'll do kind of my own thing, but taking some cues from his work. Yeah. So, yeah, I agree with you there.
Yeah, Momotaro Densetsu, the whole series has these spinoffs. So there's platformers, there's RPGs. Really, the first Dragon Quest clone of import was a Momotaro game, Peach Boy, as he's known in Japanese culture. But I have exciting news in a sense. I'm always following, like, what comes of Hudson now? You know, we can lament, has Konami done enough with them? You know, you've got Super Bomberman R was a very important launch title for Switch, one of the top selling third party titles. You've got tributes, you've got a few things, but the Momotaro games, like, you know, Jeremy was saying, are still not only living on, they're thriving. And the latest one, which I'll butcher its full name, but has in its Asia region release English language support for the first time ever. So if you guys have been curious about Momotaro, which I always have, I just picked this up. We just started stocking it at Dice City this week. You can find it through importers and so on. But
is that a Switch
game? It's a Switch title. Yeah. So and apparently one of the top 10 selling Switch titles so far in Japan are Momotaro titles. I mean, they're really carrying Konami, from what I hear. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's not right now Castlevania and Metal Gear, it's Momotaro and PS Soccer. So if you're curious about Momotaro, you go to one of these gaming conventions or a game store that has imports, you'll find the older titles. They're hard to play, but good news is the latest version on Switch in the Asia language release, region release, has English support. So I'm excited to play. There's four of us. We could be playing this right now. It's like a predecessor to Mario Party, from what I understand.
Oh, you just said some words that turned me off, but that's okay.
Mario Party? Uh-oh.
Yeah. Not that big a fan. Before we get too deeply into Famicom and PC Engine, I do want to ask if there are any computer games that they made of interest to you guys. Kurt, you've been kind of quiet, and I know that's sort of an area that you've tackled a lot. So I pulled together some of the better known ones, like Nuts and Milk, Bomberman, Binary Land, Stop the Express. You mentioned Princess Tomato. Are there any others that stick out to you that's like, oh yeah, this is, you know, part of Hudson's forgotten computer legacy?
Just Zeddyland, like I mentioned before. That would have been nice to see a port of, like they did with Princess Tomato.
All right. John?
I would have to say one game that's had a pretty good legacy along with Bomberman is one that was designed by the creator of Bomberman, Nakamoto-san. He developed Cannonball, which would also be known as Super Buster Brothers and Pang. Through a series of deals, Capcom would adapt own Cannonball, which was originally released on Japanese home computers, or home computers in general, and they would release their own for arcades called Super Buster Brothers, and also for the Super NES. And then from there, Mitchell Corporation would acquire the property outright and also release it as Pang. And so that was a game that really has had also a long legacy, you know, of you know, pretty much taking a hook and, you know, dividing these balls that are bouncing up in the air until they're no more, which was, you know, became a really addictive title, and a really successful title for Capcom, for Hudson, Capcom, and Mitchell Corporation. But I think, you know, kind of going back to what you were saying, they also made their own versions of Nintendo games. Instead of Mario Brothers. They brought a number of Nintendo games to Japanese home computers, like Ice Climber, Excite Bike, Balloon Fight. Super Mario Brothers was known as Super Mario Brothers Special. They also brought over tennis, Donkey Kong yep. 3, mm-hmm. golf.
They didn't bring over Donkey Kong 3. They made a sequel. That's the one I was talking about at the panel last night, where Donkey Kong gets alien probed.
Oh, okay.
I guess Space Invaders, Donkey Kong.
It's a really strange game, yeah.
Okay.
That would be my one that I want to play.
It wasn't called Donkey Kong 3 I have right in front of me?
Yeah, Donkey Kong 3 Daigyakushu.
Okay.
So it is a sequel.
Okay. Oh, interesting. All right. I was unaware of that. But they also made Punch Ball Mario Brothers. Mm-hmm. So I think one of these agreements they had with Nintendo was, Nintendo was like, you know what? These can't be exact, you know, ports, exact conversions. And Hudson was like, okay, well, we can add some little things here and there, right? They're like, yeah, as long as they're not exactly like ours. And that's just how those releases came about, you know? So that's really, really interesting that they were able to do that. And those were just released only to Japanese audiences.
Yeah, it's certainly a rarity to see something like that. Mm-hmm. I think the only other company they did that with was Sharp. And there's some ports of Famicom games to Zaris that came many, many years later, like a PDA. And I feel like that must have come about as, you know, some just connection with Sharp having made, had a partnership with Nintendo. And didn't Sharp have the trademark on Family Computer, which was like a home accessory, like a microwave oven or something? And there was that, you know, that's why Sharp made the Famicom, Twin Famicom, because they were like, well, we'll give you the rights to use the name Family Computer, but, you know, we get the rights to do stuff with it. So you got the, I think they also made the titler, the Famicom titler.
I remember hearing something about that.
Yeah. So that puts Hudson in pretty esteemed territory. And, you know, that was, with Sharp, it was kind of like, let's do a make good for the trademark and, you know, not infringement, but kind of the complication there. Whereas with Hudson, it was just like, you know, we're partners. And, you know, Hudson was brought into Nintendo's orbit, I think, because they had that computer experience. They understood hardware. And they understood BASIC. So, you know, Jimmy mentioned earlier that they put together the Famicom BASIC package, which was a cartridge that had BASIC functionality, allowed people to program with the use of a keyboard. They could save to a cassette tape. And, you know, that actually fed into Hudson's own releases, because they were the only company, I believe, besides Nintendo, to make use of the Famicom BASIC tape cassette for saving custom levels. Like, you can make custom Nuts and Milk and Load Runner and Castle Quest, I think, levels.
Yeah, Championship Load Runner.
Yeah. So, you know, because they built that hardware and they came up with that whole system, they said, oh, let's, you know, make this a feature of our games too. And they actually supported it better than Nintendo did. Although Nintendo was like, whatever, we got a diskette drive coming, so I don't think they were super important. Yeah, right?
We got a modem. From what I understand, Nintendo and Sharp's relationship was, you know, there was a lot going on, and they wanted Sharp to develop BASIC, and for some reason, then Sharp had a relation with Hudson, turned to Hudson, and that's how, you know, the Famicom BASIC came to be, is, you know, and Hudson developed it, basically, and that also gives them a taste of working on that higher-level hardware. And I think, you know, we miss this with the NES. I love the NES, and I love the add-ons we got, you know, the Zapper and Rob the Robot and all of the, you know, the multi-adapter stuff we got. But they did get more of that computer experience mm-hmm. in Japan because of Sharp and Hudson partnered with Nintendo to do things like the Family BASIC. And that, you know, gave Japanese players this whole completely, truly the, you know, family computer experience that we missed out on. So another experience that I think Japanese players would have and would maybe associate with Hudson. I don't know if it was widely known that they were behind Family BASIC at the time, but certainly the level editing was, from what I understand, huge in Japan. And it made a very important, you know, part of Load Runner's success. And again, we're all talking here from our knowledge, but I believe Load Runner was the first million-selling third-party game, you know, released for Nintendo hardware. So that definitely turned some heads, whether, you know, Nintendo's corporate offices or the other companies. Sega's watching this, other companies are watching this. So I think that, Lode Runner is super important. And I played it first on the Apple IIe. Mm-hmm. Great memories of it. But it was almost like, graphically, we're looking at like almost like stick drawings, you know,
right, yeah,
compared
yeah.
to what Hudson brought. So as silly as it may be to have these portly characters, like the Bomberman bad guy that appears in Lode Runner, I think it was part of the magic of Hudson and really warming the game up from this game that I was playing as a, you know, as a kid in the U.S. that was, it wasn't cutesy. It was just, it was a fun puzzle, you know, action title, but bringing it into a world, even the simple, you know, the manuals would have a little bit of story and, you know, you introduce this Bomberman character and at least in the American manuals, I think they tried to tie it into Bungling Bay. Like, I believe...
Yeah, the Bungling...
The Bungling Empire robots, yeah. or whatever were the bad guys in some of these games. But yeah, I think the Lode Runner series being the first million seller, getting the championship Lode Runner sequel, having level editors. I mean, people still play these things from what I understand. There mm-hmm. are people keeping alive these old Famicom levels they've made.
Yeah, Broderbund actually brought over Hudson Soft's Lode Runner.
Mm-hmm. And Bungling Bay, too.
Right, oh, to the U.S. Yeah,
yes.
You're right.
Yeah, yeah. And yeah, that was like, you know, the first time that for kids and customers who did not have a home computer to be able to play those computer mm-hmm. games for the first mm-hmm. time.
True.
And yeah, I mean, that was that was basically Hudson Soft's first game for the Famicom and 1.2 million units, you know, sold. So it was thanks to that Broderbund partnership that
yeah.
happened.
Yeah.
And that came out along with Nuts and Milk in July 1984. Both of those came out roughly the same time. And that was kind of, you know, the dam that broke on Famicom third parties. Namco followed soon after, and they had incredibly high-selling games too. You know, Pac-Man, Galaga, Galaxian, Zevius, of course. You know, just a big deal. So, you know, 1984 is kind of like a big turning point for Nintendo and, you know, for Hudson, and it's a big turning point in part thanks to Hudson. And, you know, Hudson was over there. They did not only the third-party releases and Family Basic, but they also created a much better version of Mahjong for Nintendo than Nintendo's own Mahjong game, Yonin Mahjong, or four-person Mahjong, which even has a penis on the title screen for the for the fans. Just kidding. So yeah, that takes us to 1985 and kind of the kickoff of, I would say, the true Famicom dominance in Japan, thanks to the influx of third parties, and it wasn't a huge gold rush quite at that point. So pretty much everything that was coming out was pretty good, pretty interesting, pretty groundbreaking, and Hudson was very much at the lead of that, and a big part of that was the Star Force port we mentioned. And, you know, for Hudson, that is a watershed moment because it is, you know, an arcade port of a Tekken arcade game. They'd already, you know, ported their own computer games with Challenger, or that was around the same time. They ported Broderbund's games, Lode Runner and Bungling Bay. But then this was an arcade game, so they were kind of exploring a new competency. And they did a great job with it, very good, strong conversion, and it became very, very popular, as you mentioned, you know, in part through the marketing. But it kicked off this whole thing that became sort of a part of the company's legacy for the next 15 years, the caravans. And this was really just like a touring roadshow to show off Star Force and yep. to say, hey, kids, come play Star Force. But it became like an event in itself that, mm-hmm. you know, kind of like the Nintendo World Championship that yes. came along a few years later. But, you know, this had its own like kind of star celebrity and challenges for kids. And it's a little cute little yellow bus that drove around. There's a VHS tape to promote Star Soldier, which was their unofficial sequel to Star Force that I digitized and posted. And, mm-hmm. Toshiyuki Takahashi is showing off how to play. He's like giving advice and techniques and stuff like that. But you get to see glimpses of kids at these caravan events, and it kind of like shows the map of it moving around Japan, and you see the bus and everything. It just feels like there was this whole corner of culture that was totally absent here, like just totally alien to us that we completely missed out on, but so integral to the kind of gaming experience of that sort of, you know, mid-80s, late Showa era. You know, kids grew up on the Famicom. This is what they remember, was, you know, the yellow bus driving around.
Yep. And I think that it's this interesting transition where video games are in the arcades, right? It's coin ops. It's the Space Invaders era, right? Japan's having coin shortages. Then video games are in the home, right? It's the family computer, and it's the MSX, and it's all these other home computers.
And also, then, you can't forget the something that Matt Alt told me about a while back, which was that there were laws passed that restricted when kids could go to public spaces like arcades on school days, and like I think 6 p.m. or something was a cutoff time. So after that, if you were a kid, you couldn't play video games unless you played them in the home.
Right,
and that
right, exactly.
Coincided with the Famicom kind of going big with third parties.
Yeah, and they had these, I mean, there were a lot of adults in Japanese arcades. You know, a lot of men,
sure.
But a lot of adults. And then this third branch all of a sudden happens now, which is, in a sense, I think, part of why we're at Retro World Expo this weekend. I mean, I've come to believe this. It's the public gaming, the gaming conventions, the competitive gaming culture where you get real life experiences. This is common now. I mean, people will get together for a Smash Bros. Tournament. You know, we have Super Smash Con or whatever it's now called in Washington, D.C., where I'm based out of. But all of a sudden, this is not just people in an arcade tracking scores on a cabinet and sending them off to a magazine, whatever probably predated Famitsu. You know, it's now real life. You're watching the masters of your region play at these caravan events. People are following it around the country. I heard they expected 2,000 people for one of the early events, and 20,000 showed up. And now the Hudson Caravan is touring the country. It's going to a variety of cities. You're starting to see, I don't know if we can call them pro gamers yet, but certainly established gamers. Who are seen as masters, you know, of the genre, and they are playing in finals, and there's a tournament structure. That's extremely common in American gaming culture right now, whether it's things like Pokemon, Magic the Gathering, Warhammer, and video games. And this is very common for us. For us, I think it evolves out of Gen Con, where they played war games and then Dungeons & Dragons and Magic the Gathering. In Japan, I think that the predecessor, from what I understand, is the caravan. This is the first time Japanese gamers are coming together, playing with each other in both a fun and competitive environment. And Hudson's leading the charge. They're developing a marketing style that's really unique. And they're partnered. The van is sponsored by TDK, Sharp, and all of a sudden their partners are using the opportunity to roll out new technology. I don't know if we want to get into Hi-10 Bomberman and the introduction of HD screens to Japanese culture yet. That's coming.
I think that's a little further out.
But it's amazing what they were doing. And all of a sudden you're playing with that Hudson joystick that we didn't get in America, but people love it. You know, it's a little yellow Famicom joystick. So they're rolling out new games. They're rolling out celebrities like Takashi Meijin. They're rolling out competitive gaming culture, and they're rolling out new hardware. And I think that's just got to be revolutionary for Japanese gaming culture.
Yeah. I mean, you want to look at how different that culture was and how big it was when they adapted Wonder Boy to Famicom. They said we should change up the character because Westone owns that. So instead of, you know, just creating a new character or licensing a celebrity likeness like with Kato and Ken, they were like, let's make our own guy, our own celebrity, the hero. It's Takahashi Meijin. He's got his trucker hat and his underbite, and he's out there in a grass skirt, just like in real life.
His big forearms.
Yep. So, it really does speak to this kind of phenomenon that they were at the vanguard of.
Yeah.
And this caravan was making appearances on Japanese TV as well. Mm-hmm. They were getting a lot of publicity, on certain shows. Mm-hmm. And I might be mistaken on this, but I think this caravan would travel during Japanese summers. Yep. So like when kids had school vacation. So, you know, and this is one of the things that kids could look forward to in their summer vacations is seeing the Hudson Caravan, and being able to meet Takahashi Meijin, who was just like, you know, who really became kind of like a superhero to these kids.
And a true national celebrity, from what I understand. Not just a pro gamer. He's a national celebrity.
Yeah, and he's making appearances as well, you know, with his nickname and stuff like that. So that, yeah, big impact there. And that sponsorship, those sponsorships that they had, you know, with TDK, and they still had in 85 that strong relationship with Sharp. Hudson Soft had such a strong relationship with Sharp that they actually moved their Tokyo offices right down the street, a 10-minute walk from Sharp's offices in Tokyo. So that's how strong that relationship was.
My understanding is, you know, when arcades first started coming out, there was a lot of big competition. But as the years went on in America, I mean, I was really young at the time, but I'd gotten the impression it's kind of just kind of like a niche thing compared to what Hudson was doing and really like pulling kids in all over and created that whole competitive culture, which we didn't start to get like really for a while. And it also changed the way that shoot 'em ups in general, the whole genre, was, because in North America, they really had it a little rough compared to how prolific they were in Japan. Because Space Invaders was popular everywhere. Zevius came out, tremendously popular in Japan. Atari brought it here, and I don't think it was a flop, but it didn't remotely have the same level of effect. And then Hudson came in, and they started Star Force and Star Soldier, and again, promotion. That became such a big part of it. That channeled everything up until like the Street Fighter boom. so it's just going off of what you said, just how important they was. Yeah. Like between Zevius and everything they did with Star Soldier, the effects we still see in video games everywhere today.
And your book has your shoot 'em up book, which I've at least thumbed through. got it off Amazon. Is
Thank
great
you.
For covering the Star Soldier series.
Yeah,
And it didn't stop at Star Force and Star Soldier. What was next?
Hector 87. Right. Starship Hector. I think it was
Starship
called.
Hector in Japan. Yeah. Hector 87.
Hector 87 in Japan. Starship Hector over here.
Yeah. And it was part of that caravan tradition. Right. So it's like this is the 1987 game.
Before you had Madden, right?
Speaking of, there's something I was just reading a little bit. They started off with all shooters, and then in a certain year they switched to power some sports game.
Yep.
I forget what it was.
Their baseball series.
Yeah.
Power League, I believe it was.
At the same time, they had made that game. In America, it's called Zexies, which is not a pure shooter game. It's like part side scroller, part shoot 'em up. And I think at one point they may have been positioned, but something went weird in development and that got shoved aside. But there was one of the Hudson Soft developers was on Twitter a while ago, Hiromasa Iwasaki, and posted a little story about the title of that game. Because in Japan, it's tied in with the legend of Taro Urashima, I think. And all that stuff was wallpapered over here when we got it. And it was specifically given that title because it was about Japanese folklore. And Momotaro Densetsu and Momotaro Dentetsu were both extraordinarily popular. So like, a game that was named after Japanese folklore. Even though its relation is very, very tiny.
This brings us to the end of 1985, 1986, and a bunch of things start happening at once. Hudson's releasing these very popular games on Famicom, but Nintendo releases Super Mario Brothers, and they're like, that's it, that's as much as we can do with this hardware, so time to come out with the peripheral, and they come out with the Famicom Disk System. Around the same time, Sega finally says, you know what, the SG-1000 isn't cutting it, let's put together a variant on this system that's the same basic CPU and architecture, but has this powerful new video display processor, and suddenly that leaps the capabilities of the Famicom. You start seeing the memory management chips come out from other publishers, and just kind of in the general atmosphere of technology, there's kind of a landmark for Moore's Law that's hit around this time, and 16-bit processors become very commonplace as opposed to being like a thing that our, kind of super expensive and inaccessible. So you start to see them in arcade machines. You start to see the Amiga, the Atari ST. The Macintosh becomes a little more affordable, though not really affordable. So, you know, all of a sudden 16-bit technology is in the air and it's accessible. And I think Hudson, you know, being tinkerers and tech savants, start to look at all these advances and they see themselves kind of bound to, you know, like tethered to Nintendo's baseline technology and start thinking, well, that's fine, but we could do better. So, you know, the company was so big at this point, they had such a huge staff that they had a division that was just like, let's experiment with technology and make hardware and see what we can come up with. You know, that's where you get the the high 10 Bomberman and stuff. Like, they have a whole division dedicated to like creating HDTV a decade or two before it becomes commonplace. So they create basically the Master System version of the Famicom, where it's, you know, the baseline 6502, but also there's this incredible new graphics display processor that, you know, is 16-bit and or has 16-bit bandwidth and can do so much more. And they bring it to Nintendo, and Nintendo's basically like, hey, that's neat, but we don't take cold calls that upend our business model. Like, you know, Atari would take, or Lynx, Epix and Atari would try to sell the Lynx to them. And they were like, well, no, we're doing our own. So Nintendo, you know, they'll take meetings, but they're not going to take exterior solicitations on fundamental levels of their business. It has to be sort of an internally generated thing. So Nintendo's just kind of like, thanks guys, but we're not going to do that. It's okay if you want to continue experimenting with it though. Like, we're all friends here. It's okay. You know, according to an interview on shmuplations.com, you know, Hudson, their staff kind of heard through the grapevine that Hiroshi Yamauchi, president of NCL, was like, yeah, it's fine if they want to just, you know, do their own thing. So they team up with NEC, who was very interested in getting into the home computer space or home console space after having made all these home computers, and they collaborate. So NEC manufactures the system. Hudson has designed it. Hudson has like the bandwidth and capacity to create all kinds of games for it. And out of this emerges the PC Engine, a console that leapfrogs the Master System, Mark III, which had leapfrogged the Famicom, and is an amazing cutting-edge piece of game technology in 1987. This is the thing that I'm trying to get across with my TurboGrafx videos, is like, yeah, when TurboGrafx launched in America, it was impressive, but the Sega Genesis came out a couple of weeks before, and that was more impressive. But if you go back in time to 1987 and you're looking at, you know, NES games, like, you know, the cutting edge is Mike Tyson's Punch-Out, really. Like, that's the coolest, biggest graphics you can do. And here's the PC Engine with, you know, the Kung Fu, China Warrior, with, like, these incredible, like, jaw-dropping video games. Victory Run, an OutRun clone that is better than the home version of OutRun. Like, no one is doing anything like this. This is bleeding-edge technology, and it's, you know, it's NEC, but really it's Hudson bringing this to you. So you've got this lineage of all these great games that you loved on Famicom, you know, the Star Force guys, Star Soldier guys, they're here, the Bomberman guys, they're here, they're giving you this new system. Can you imagine what it's going to be? And, you know, a year after that, NEC brings out the PC Engine CD-ROM-ROM and is the first consumer-level gaming device to run off optical media. And that's a massive jump over what had come before also. So, yeah, PC Engine was, it was mind-blowingly good when it came out in Japan. You know, it kind of missed the boat here a bit and never really caught up. But in Japan, it was staggering. Like, everyone who was kind of getting tired of the stale technology of Famicom and was ready for something new and different, the PC Engine was there for them. And, you know, within a year, it was outselling the Famicom pretty handily, I think.
Listen, the story of Hudson being they were popular in Japan, but as far as coming up in America, they didn't quite have the same opportunities because it was just a little, the timeline was lagging.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, Hudson did not establish a U.S. office until 1988.
Because who brought out Star Trolder? That was Taxon, right? I think.
Yes, it was.
Yeah, and that was a brand of Naxxat. Mm-hmm. And who, I think they had, by the time Starship Hector came out, that was Hudson, right?
You mean, like, publishing?
Yeah, publishing in America, yeah. Yeah, I think so. But, I mean, it's like the Broderbund brought out Loadrunner, but at that time, I mean, people knew Loadrunner just because of the computer game, even though they hadn't really played it, but since it did come out so late, it just wasn't as impressive, felt a little old.
Yep.
Mylon's Secret Castle was another one of those games that, I mean, I would have always gotten the impression, I remember reading reviews at the time, people hated it. And I read on Japanese sites.
Except video games and computer entertainment, they dedicated like entire strategy guides 2 years later to Mylon's Secret Castle. It was a weird magazine.
I love that magazine.
They loved it.
Yeah, I mean, I remember that's how I beat like Alex Kidd in Miracle World and Wonder Boy 3 and all that stuff.
But what were you saying in Japan?
Yeah, because somebody requested that I write about it. I'm like, oh, let's read about what they say in Japan. And they gave it, like, glowing reviews.
Right.
Because there was the whole design trend of just, like, really obscure stuff, like puzzle solving. Mm-hmm. And they would have whole guides and cultures of doing that. And plus, compared to arcade games where you would just, like, try to beat it, but if you could beat it, then it was basically done unless you're trying to get a higher score. Like, sitting down with a game and trying to solve a puzzle was the game. And that was heavily what Mylon's Secret Castle was based off of. Yeah. There's something like that combined with a platformer like Mario. When it came out, we didn't quite have that same level of things. We didn't have the... there weren't very many magazines again at the time when it came out. Right. Again, yeah. Two years later, I mean, there was a couple of them, but I think video games.
The time Mylon's Secret Castle came out, the only U.S. video game focused magazines were Nintendo Power, which had just launched.
Yeah,
like it was brand spanking new, and of course Computer Entertainer, but they didn't really trade in strategy guides. They were too slim. It was like a newsletter.
Yeah. So when American kids got it here, they're like, I don't know what's going on. I don't understand how to play this game. It sucks. Which, I mean,
yeah.
Understandable given that context.
In Japan, Mylon was a contemporary of Atlantis No Nazo. And, you know, you look at it in that light, and it's like, well, you know, this is very esoteric and difficult, but it's not that esoteric and difficult. It's still a much friendlier game.
Yeah, it's much better than that and yeah. Super Pitfall and those sorts of games.
I think Mylon's a very important game, and I get a little hoarse at these cons, by the way,
sure,
so you'll hear that in my voice, forgive me, podcast, but I think Mylon's really misunderstood here now. I actually think, I wouldn't say I disagree with you, Kurt, but I think while we may say it was slammed in the U.S., my lived experience, and you'll see this reflected if you look at articles or YouTube videos, you will see a Mylon crowd that is a casual Mylon crowd. I'm not talking about us guys who've maybe studied this or played it extensively. And they're going, no, I loved Mylon. I loved renting Mylon Secret Castle. That was my favorite game. And then you'll hear people like, what the heck are you talking about? That was the worst game. It's poorly designed. It's poorly programmed. And to have this, you know, these bipolar, you know, opinions on Mylon Secret Castle, I'm in the camp that when it came out, really enjoyed it. I rented it, and something, you know, differences in Japanese American culture. I don't know if they had the same video store boom we had. I don't know if they had big VHS culture in Japan, but I don't know how it compared. I wasn't there, not my lived experience. But in America, my video store would have certain games that they would have their own little, let's call it a manual cheat sheet inside of the case. So you'd rent it just like you would a VHS in this clamshell. And the Mylon Secret Castle clamshell had very basic things. And they were written in these short sentence cover letters. Level 1, music box, 6 block. Hit the white wall, door opens, top right. You know, like B near second door. And that allowed you to discover things. And that culture to us was cool. In Japan, it was huge. And it was, from what I understand, part of the playground culture. Kids at school are talking about what they uncovered in Myland Secret International, how far they got. And they're going back and replaying it and discovering new things. So it's a game of discovery, not a bad Mario clone. And I think some people in America just miss that.
Yeah, Japan didn't have a rental culture because their rental culture was struck down by Nintendo in the courts. Mm. So that didn't exist. Mm. But what they did have was a strategy guide culture.
Right.
I think in large part because Super Mario Brothers came out, its strategy guide, you know, that we got here is how to win at Super Mario. Tokuma Shoten brought that out in Japan, and it was a bestseller. It ran up the charts. It was, you know, it was everywhere, like a huge hit. And like that opened up its own floodgates. If you go back, you know, go over to Japanese shops, you can find strategy guides for Famicom games going all the way back to like 1986 or so. And any game of any notability got a strategy guide. I mean, I found a strategy guide for the Japanese version of Rogue, which I wish I had bought because I can't even imagine what that guide would be like. But yeah, like that was just a thing. Like yep. if you played a game, you would go buy the strategy guide for it. You know, it cost like 400 yen. It wasn't expensive. It was this cheap little flimsy paperback, but full color, and it had all the tips. You know, 60 pages, you're good to go. And we didn't really have that. We had to wait until, you know, 2 years later when VG and CE posted their like 6-page Myland strategy guide in a very kind of bland-looking magazine that only grown-ups read.
And we'd later get these compilations. Before we really were getting Strategy Guide, I remember getting these How to Win at Nintendo or whatever type of books.
Jeff Rogen, that's how I made Bank.
Those are very boring.
I have the Japanese strategy guides for most of the early Hudson games. I'm not sure about Nuts and Milk, Binary Land, stuff like that, but in this era...
I think
era,
that predates that guy.
Yeah, exactly. I was going to say, in this era, everyone got it. So I've got the Star Soldier, I've got the Myland Secret Castle, and so on. And each one, these, to give you context, they're very different than our large form American strategy guides. They're slender, physically. They're smaller. They're about half page. And they have a glossy jacket, and they have some full color pages, and they're very nice. And they do a really good job of highlighting art from the games. Like the Star Soldier will have the, you know, the Caesar, you know, vehicle somewhere in it, this ship. And it will have a large, you know, the Star Brain is a big graphic on or inside the book. With Myland, we didn't get all that. If you look through the Myland's manual, it does give you some tips and it has some of the drawings. And you see this Myland that is this cute little character with his sleeping cap or whatever it is on, almost like a little Nemo. But then when you look at the Japanese version, the box arts were often different and these strategy guides led with that art. So if you look at Load Runner, we got the Western art. Load Runner in Japan has a very cartoony style, and that's followed up on Battle Load Runner and some of the other games. Myland, the Japanese, the culture around video games, they got to see that sort of cartoony Myland that almost looks like Wind Waker era Link. And that was something that resonated with them. So the Hudson characters, I think, stood out. The strategy guides brought them to life. And you saw that with Bomberman, with Load Runner, and with Myland. And so they're developing this aesthetic, lots of yellows and blues and these really cute cartoony characters that Japanese children relate to. And I think that will continue to be a part of the Hudson story in Japan. But I love Myland. I'm just going to throw this out here while we're on the subject before we move on. Apocryphal take. Is it the first Metroidvania?
No. But it is. I do put it in my Metroidvania chronology, for sure.
I mean, it comes out a little after Metroid, but it is very early in that development, and I think it has a lot of the hallmarks of those games. I think it's very easy to see, well, you're breaking blocks, and there's treasures in some of them. Is it Mario? No. This is a game of exploration. It's a game of powering up your character, managing resources, and retracing your steps, finding new ways to get to the boss or get to the next item you need to move on.
Yeah, it's an adventure game with a pixel hunt, except the pixel hunt is shooting blocks. So, you know, kind of like drawing from Mario there and applying it to a different genre and sort of creating this hybrid. But I don't want to get too bogged down on Myland because we really, you know, are kind of short on time and battery life. But I do think Myland and Hudson Soft USA are important to mention because it shows that while Hudson had this console that they were really kind of spearheading along with NEC, they didn't stop making games for Nintendo's system. They were still... they were still partners with Nintendo. They continued making Famicom software. It was like, and it wasn't even like, this is where we kind of slum it. This is where the bad stuff goes that we, you know, just want to make some quick money off of. Like, some of their games are really great. I mean, Hudson published the final Famicom official release in Japan, which was, you know, Adventure Island 4. And they continued to push the boundaries as much as they could within, like, the MMC3 chip kind of zone. And made some really great games that they published in Japan. They published here. They put into Europe alongside the PC Engine and TurboGrafx. And, you know, maybe that's bad business sense. Like, hey, we're, you know, we have our own console, but also we're making games for the much more popular console of our competition. But, you know, internally, based on Hudson's own commentary, they didn't see themselves as competing with Nintendo. It was like, here's the alternative. You can play Famicom games, you can play our games on Famicom, or you can buy our system, and you can have a different experience. It's more pristine, more arcade accurate. It's going to be, you know, more visually impressive, but either one is still valid, and we're there for both. So, you know, pick your poison, choose your own adventure. We're there for you. We're Hudson. We love you. We want you to play our video games.
Yeah, and they were making accessories, too. They were... Mm-hmm. They made the Famicom Joy-Card SSS. It was, you know, I mean, they were making these controllers yeah. that were accessible for
great and controllers.
Great controllers.
Like ergonomic form, the rounded corners. Wasn't that the first turbo controller?
I'm not sure if it was the first, but it was.
One of the things I was reading was that the turbo controller concept emerged from the Caravans and Master Takahashi because. You know, he was famous for being able to press the fire button 16 or actually 17 times a second.
But 16 which sounds better.
It does. It sounds more computer like, he said, you know, 16-bit. But, you know, the average person can't do that. So if you want to play like Master Takahashi, you know, here is a button you can just hold down and it auto-fires for you. You know, it's rapid fire. And they built that into the TurboGrafx, the PC engine. You know, you have the turbo option on the controller.
Yeah, and they're taking in. They took a pretty big risk in bringing this controller over to the USA. Mm-hmm. They did. I had to look up when they opened up Hudson Soft USA, mm-hmm. and they. I checked the California Business Registry, and they opened up. It was registered on June 30th, 1987, and that's. It was probably. It was the same year that Broderbund was publishing. Couple of Hudson Soft's first two titles. So Hudson Soft was like, we need to get over to the US. Whereas it's pretty surprising that Hudson Soft would not open a European office until August 1991 in Hamburg, Germany. So they did see the United States as a priority first. And that's when they began releasing, you know, one of my favorite shoot 'em up games from Hudson Soft for the NES has to be Star Soldier. Mm-hmm. I mean, that game is just amazing. And it was, I think it was originally released in June of 1986 for the Famicom, but did not come over to the States until, I believe...
January 89
from Taxan. So, I mean, considering that they were able to do all of this stuff simultaneously, 1987 just was an explosive year. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And then we haven't mentioned them by name, but the Sharp X1 and the NEC, the PC8801 and these other, you know, computers, this is all at once. So they're releasing Super Mario Bros. Special and they're releasing Mylan Secret Castle and they're, you know, developing the PC Engine and, you know, that's something they would always do, I think, really. You'll see it even later when they had games on the Saturn and games on the Nintendo 64. Again, won't jump ahead, but they kept multiple systems going, supported every platform for a very long time.
But at the same time, they were kind of slow to build in the U.S. I mean, you know, they didn't publish their first games until September 88 here, self-publish. Mm-hmm. And I think that kind of leads into maybe one of the downfalls of the TurboGrafx-16, which is that One, it arrived here late. It arrived after the Mega Drive. The Genesis came here, even though it launched a year before the Mega Drive in Japan. So that's, you know, that's rough. But also, Hudson didn't handle the distribution and marketing themselves. They just didn't have, I think, the bandwidth in the U.S. So they passed that over to NEC America. And I don't think NEC did a great job of handling the TurboGrafx. I think if Hudson, you know, had applied their own experience and knowledge that they had, you know, mastered in Japan, I think the TurboGrafx could have been a much more successful system here. But NEC, you know, their Turbo's marketing, it was kind of cool. Like, it had a style and a personality. You know, before you get to the Johnny Turbo cartoons and stuff like that, like their early launch games, which is just like fragments of imagery and stuff like that.
Futuristic.
Yeah, lasers. Like the yeah. orange boxes and everything, like a very unified front. It's actually really cool, but I feel like it's kind of cool in the same way that Master System's grid, you know, that box art is also kind of cool. And it's like, here's a unified front, but at the same time, it doesn't have the vibrance and excitement of, you know, some of the competing systems. It doesn't really get the point across. Genesis, the box for Genesis, you've got the console, but you've also got this freaking huge, like, off-screen scanline photo of one of the transformation sequences of Altered Beast. And it's saying, like, right there, this is the video game that you are going to get. Look at how badass this looks. And it's very compelling in 1989. For a child to look at that and say, whoa, that is going to be on my TV, amazing.
And it's about the size of like, your TV, too.
Yeah, you know,
if you've got a 14 to 30-inch TV, which was the common size range, I would say, that a kid has access to in the American home, that Genesis box is big.
Yeah.
And it looks, it's shaped like a TV, right? Yeah. It's like that 4x3 format.
Yeah, that square, yeah.
You know, and you're like, I'm getting this arcade game at home. And we loved werewolves and stuff back then.
Oh, yeah.
So that's, you know, Altered Beast, I mean, spoke to the American TV.
Yeah, it's like Teen Wolf right there.
Yeah.
There's one anecdote that calls to how messy and chaotic Hudson's development was, apparently, in the late 80s, which was for Xanadu. So they had licensed to port Xanadu to the PC. But they ran into a lot of problems because Xanadu was a really complex game. They weren't able to get access to the source code or really much in any type of design documents. So the guy in charge of it just kind of threw up his hands and said, I'm going to make my own game.
It's great. I love it.
The fact that that even happened speaks to how messy it was, because you'd expect like a manager or a boss or something like that to go over his shoulder and say, you can't do that. But it happened, and it caused a lot of problems for Hudson when they went to license Ease for the PC Engine, because it was a huge embarrassment for everybody. Like, we like Fizanadu kind of, sort of, here, because it was...
I love it.
I love it, too.
Yeah,
it was... I think we're coming to love it.
Yeah.
That's, you know,
it was positioned since 1989, by God.
Yeah. It was positioned as like a follow-up to Zelda 2, and it didn't have all that baggage, whereas, you know, Japanese gamers expected something vaguely like Xanadu. Mm. So when they had gone to Hudson to negotiate the Ease license, the president did not like them. They didn't really want to do the deal, so they quoted him an absurd price. And Hudson was like, you know what? We really believe in this game. We're going to do it. And it turned out really well for everybody. So that patched everything else.
Yeah, I mean, Hudson ended up developing Ease 4, or one of the Ease 4s.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. So it was a good, fruitful relationship for a while. But yeah, again, the fact that even happened in the first place showed that there maybe wasn't a... oversight.
Right. But then, on the other hand, Nintendo published Xanadu in the U.S., right? So they saw the potential, and they even packaged it with, I don't know if it's the same font, but a very similar font to Final Fantasy.
Yeah.
And I think they were messaging to us. And again,
Final Fantasy came the year later. It was kind of like the midpoint between Zelda 2 and Final Fantasy.
Right. Yeah. Exactly. It's both.
Yeah. Yeah.
But my point is that we're in this... There's a whole other cultural boom in the U.S. with Dungeons & Dragons, you know, and eventually Magic the Gathering and this fantasy world that, again, really spoke to me. You know, we're reading Tolkien and playing Dungeons & Dragons, and all of a sudden these video games are coming out with this unique Japanese developed style action RPG or RPG, but this aesthetic that speaks to us, and that the box art for Xanadu, that was another one of those. I rented it. Dwarves and elves, an amazing score. I mean, and I just fell in love with it. And I have so many Hudson games that began as rentals and now are very important parts of my collection. And And yeah, their relationship with Falcom, I think, ended up being good. They did a couple games. It was Wise Foremost, famously, but I think they did the 1 and 2 remake for PSP, or they worked on a couple things, and
yeah.
They earned the respect of everyone they worked with sooner or later, you know.
It might have taken them a while, but yeah, they got there. So we need to wrap it up, but final thoughts on Hudson and leading up to the TurboGrafx. I'd like to do, you know, revisit the TurboGrafx at some point now that I'm dug into it some more and we'll be spending more time with it. But kind of getting there, any last thoughts on this legacy and what made Hudson so special and put them in such a unique position to be able to compete with Nintendo but also be their buddies? That's very rare.
I'll say this. I think we need a part two. I mean, you know, you're going to keep going, but I think this is an awesome discussion. I'm really happy to be a part of it. And like I said, it was just their a couple things. One thing is their willingness to work with everybody, to work on every franchise, and to learn from everything they did. I'm sitting here with a pile of games here from our booth at the convention. Monster Lair, Dynastic Hero, you know. They would continue to work on their own variations of Wonder Boy games.
Mm-hmm.
You know, again, without getting discussion, I think they're great versions. They made Far East of Eden. They published it. You know, they worked very close with Red. And anyone they worked with, they had close relationships, and they learned from. I'm looking at a Far East of Eden Bomberman clone here that was a Japanese exclusive.
And, I've never heard of that. Amazing.
Oh, this thing is cool. Check this out. But yeah, I think that was that colorful marketing. It was that willingness to step out and understand Japanese culture. Huh. I think it was the eagerness to work with new technology. But when they worked with, you know, the older technology, the withered technology, they did a great job. So, and that aesthetic, if you look at every game, they're blue and green and red. And that, how do you say it? The Hachisuki? How do you say the bee? The name of the bee in Japanese.
Oh, I don't know. Hachisuki?
Logo, though, I mean, it's just amazing. They were really good at the marketing. They were really good at the big sprites. I mean, we barely touched on that. You kind of did with, you know, some of the martial arts games, the Jackie Chan and stuff. But they, the big sprites were so important to me. Again, with when I first saw Blanc, and so to bring it to the Turbo... Turbo did need a mascot, and it did end up playing
Keith Courage was not it.
It was not Keith Courage. And ended up playing in the same space as Sega, and kind of what I think later was what Microsoft tried to do with Xbox. Black, big, bold console, neon green, kind of the extreme, you know, we have the same color scheme in Mountain Dew, I hate to say, because I love the TurboGrafx so much more than Mountain Dew, but at the end of the day, they understood that they needed to change for the West, and whether they succeeded or not, whether NEC hindered it or not, I think is the next discussion to have, but damn, did they bring the games, they brought the programming, they brought the spites, they brought the scores. I mean, if you go back to Bomberman or Faxanadu, they just did so many things right. And I think that was the setup, is they're willing, anything that worked on the arcade or the computer, they were willing to try on the Famicom, and they were willing to soup up for the PC Engine and the TurboGrafx.
John?
I think, this does definitely deserves a part two. I agree. 1987 was the, you know, most explosive year for Hudson Soft. With the PC Engine, the TurboGrafx 16, man, if only Sharp had released their X1 Twin with the computer with the PC Engine built in overseas, then maybe there would have been a little bit more availability in an audience. I'm surprised that even happened. And any a Sharp, this is an, you know, NEC allowing Sharp and Hudson to put out, you know, a combo computer. Just incredible. And what's great is that since pretty much the Hudson Soft's publishing, their own establishment, kind of early, but a bit early, you know, in the U.S., we have a great availability of Hudson Soft titles to learn about, that audiences can learn about. And they left behind quite a legacy. I'm shocked that Nintendo didn't acquire Hudson Soft outright, and that Konami ended up acquiring Hudson. So we're long overdue for, you know, a look back at Hudson in terms of a re-release of these games, of a compilation, volumes and volumes of a compilations of Hudson Soft games. That's where we need to go. That's right. What's ahead.
When I was a kid, I barely knew anything about Hudson. I mean, following Nintendo stuff, like as far as third parties, it was all Konami and Capcom. So going back years later and tracing the steps and seeing how big they were in Japan was really a little shocking. And it's just because they were late in catching up on things, or they weren't able to market as effectively as the same way they were in Japan. And as it went on, the games that were so popular for them would just be inscrutable to the American audience at the time. Like Mobotaro Densetsu, you said, massively popular, completely unplayable to anybody. Far East of Eden was, you know, not quite to the level of Dragon Quest and Final Fantasy, but it was up there.
Yep. Again, the third one, if you're saying the big three, the third one in Japan.
And, I think the first one finally got fan translated a little while ago. Mm-hmm. But otherwise, they're RPGs. They are unplayable to anybody that's not fluent in Japanese. So there's this just huge chunk that we were missing out on. And just the flailing popularity, I mean, like, Bonk was relatively popular, but stuff like that just didn't really take off. And it's unfortunate, because they really were a big player at the time, and some more knowledge of them. I mean, the best we got was, I think, the PC Engine Mini that they put out four or five years ago.
Which was pretty good.
It's a great little mini console.
Maybe the best.
Right, for listeners at home, the TurboGrafx-16 Mini, you can find both, but it's a great place to start if we're talking about compilation. It's not everything, but it is a great place to start. It has Rondo of Blood, doesn't it? I mean, it's got the shooters.
Yeah, yeah.
It even touches on, it's got Sapphire.
It's got SD Snatcher, doesn't it?
Yeah.
It has exactly. The original Snatcher.
Yeah, okay. It does.
But
it
only
does.
In Japanese.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It's even on the American one, they kept it on there. I think the Japanese one has Tokyo
Mechamoro. No, I mean, it's only in Japanese language.
Yeah, they didn't translate it, yeah.
Yeah, that sold out really fast. Yeah. They needed to make more of those.
Yeah,
so, you know, my final thought is just that digging into Hudson for TurboGrafx, TurboWorks that I'm doing, the videos, and for this podcast, it's really making a lot of the pieces of Japanese games history fall into place in a way that I hadn't quite grasped before. Mm-hmm. And I kind of need to go back and redo my my Famicom NES Works guide-in videos, but I can't do that. I don't have time for that. No one wants that. So I'll just have to fold it into my knowledge and my work going forward. But yeah, just like a truly momentous company, like truly essential to the history of video games in general, and in a way that I don't think people over here really appreciate. And it is a shame that they've just kind of been subsumed and disappeared into Konami. Although, you know, some of the talent is still around. Yeah. You know, when we did the Ninja 5.0 reissue at Limited Run, I was able to connect with the developers on that game who are still at Konami, and they, you know, they kind of poured their passion, and we're very clear about how much they cared about that game that came out more than 20 years ago. So, you know, like that talent and that enthusiasm is still there. It was a big part of why the TurboGrafx Mini was so good, because it was someone who was there and was part of that and really believed in it and wanted it to be the best that it could be. And, you know, so I think that the light under the bushel is kind of, you know, being hidden from everyone, but it's still there. It's still burning away. So, Hudson, pretty awesome. Love those guys. Great games. Too bad that, you know, they just didn't quite connect with most Americans in the same way that they connected with the Japanese audiences. But that doesn't make their work any less interesting or significant.
Yeah. Time to go back and discover it.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
All right, so this has been Retronauts. Thanks, everyone, for listening. I do think we will have to follow up this conversation with, you know, beyond the TurboGrafx launch. But in the meantime, you can listen to other Retronauts podcasts on just about any device that you, or any platform you like. We are out there peddling our wares, our podcast. And we do literally peddle on Patreon, patreon.com/retronauts. It's how we fund coming to events like this to record with cool people that we randomly meet on the convention show floor and turn into a great conversation. So yes, thanks, Jimmy, for joining us. Where can we find you on the internet and in physical space even?
Right. Thanks for asking. at Dice City Games DC, primarily active on Instagram, less extent X, Twitter. We're also Dice City on Facebook. We're very active there. And then, of course, our store is in the Washington, D.C. suburbs. So we're located in Silver Spring, Maryland.
Oh, okay.
And hoping to expand into Northern Virginia soon. And we kind of do the circuit of a lot of these great cons. We pretty regularly are at Midwest Gaming Classic, Too Many Games, MAGFest, Retro World Expo, and so on.
Yeah, one of our regular contributors, Kevin Bunch, lives very close to Silver Springs.
Nice.
Do you know him at all?
I'm not sure I do. We get a lot.
We
got to
make a love connection there.
Yeah, please do.
Yeah.
But come into the store because you'll always find Hudson Games. That's nothing else. My whole thing with I never say we're a video game store. We're a retro game store. Mm. You know, we're not a tabletop store. That's we are a Dungeons and Dragons Magic.
There's no Roblox store. Cards.
No, please don't bring me any, I don't know, what are the Skylanders, please. No treatments like that. But if you've got TurboGrafx 16 games, we pay top dollar. And if you just want to come by a booth and talk, you know, crap like this with someone, I'm here and I love it. Our PVMs are often demoing games. Mm. You know, we're playing Mylon Secret Castle and, you know, Monster Lair and so on. So come through, say hi, have fun with us at a convention. Pick up one of these guys' books. I'm excited to delve in further to these books, but yeah, definitely follow Dice City Games and come find us at a convention, and you'll see more of me soon.
All right. And John, I think this is your first time on Retronauts, isn't it?
Yes, that's right.
So where can we find you on the internet and in real life? Well, you probably don't want us to find you in real life.
No. Please don't show up at my front door. You can find me on Blue Sky, and basically my Blue Sky address where I post about video game history stuff, that would be at johnanderson.bsky.social.
All right. And Kurt?
I'm at hardcoregaming101.net. On Blue Sky, I'm HG101. I also do a lot of books. I self-publish a lot of stuff. Some of my stuff is through Bitmap Books, where I wrote a PC Engine box art collection book. I also did separate stuff on shoot 'em ups and RPGs. And we also have a podcast, the top 47,858 games of all time, where I'm sure we probably discussed some Hudson stuff in there somewhere.
I would imagine, yes.
Yeah, just by the... We're like about 1,500 games into that list.
If you haven't talked about anything from Hudson yet...
We've gotten there, yeah.
And finally, you can find me, Jeremy Parrish, on Blue Sky as jparrish.bluesky.whateveritis. Social, that's it, yes. And you can find me... Here on Retronauts, you can find me on YouTube as Jeremy Parrish, just one R in Parrish, thank you. And I'm also doing stuff at Limited Run Games. You can check out books from our print label, Press Run. A lot of them are from me. And also, you know, sometimes you'll buy a collector's edition. I saw a few of my collector's editions out there, and you'll find something from me inside, like hand-drawn maps of Castlevania or whatever. So, that's where you can find me and us. And of course, Retronauts is at patreon.com/retronauts and retronauts.com. We love you. Thank you for listening. We love Hudson. Thanks for playing. Let's go play some Hudson games.